shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico.
A program most deserving of a grand introduction.
The Nocturnal Journal.
The talk of the town. WGN Radio 720.
With your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
Daytime turns me off and I don't mean maybe. 9 to 5 ain't taking me where I'm bound. When it's gone, I run out to see my...
Welcome to Nocturnal Journal on Saturday night. I've got a wonderful show. We've got a house band tonight. We've got the Dumpster Babies. They're going to be playing in a little bit. We have singer-songwriter Ann Soldes coming in around 10 o'clock. We're going to talk about regional music in the Ozarks at the 9:30 hour. And our first guests are some friends of ours, Vanessa Stokes and Keith Brownlee. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And so tell us, Vanessa, about your dad's photography and the photography of, sure. of your father, Doral Creighton.
Yes. So my father was an immigrant and immigrated here from Jamaica in the late 50s,
to
early
Chicago.
60s. Yeah, to Chicago. And after some years being here, he decided that he wanted to pursue photography. So he moved to Sweden and started his business there in Stockholm. And stayed there for a few years, came back, and started his business here in Chicago. He had the first photography studio owned by a black man in
Where
Chicago.
Was that at?
It was like in the photography district, which is like off of Hubbard, like Hubbard Street. He had a couple of studios in that area for many years, like most of the 70s, I would say. Yeah.
And what did he do before photography? I mean, I met you guys. I mean, he was a window designer
in
the South Suburbs.
Yeah, so he worked at a department store, and did window designing. So one of the things that he really enjoyed was looking at the fashion of the time. So he looked at the fashion, you know, in magazines, and he really, really got into, you know, just a lot of the photographers at that time.
Such as,
it's not coming to mind.
Richard Avedon.
Yes. Yeah. Richard Avedon was one of the ones that he really enjoyed. Yeah.
And he used fashion magazines as a template for some of his stuff?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, and then when he was in Sweden, that's pretty much what he took pictures of, was like fashion, like a lot of models, a lot of fashion. You know, he started really getting into nudes at that point, but doing a lot of portraits, I would say.
Doral Creighton. Now, why did he go to Sweden to hone his craft as opposed to New York or Los Angeles or Paris?
Europe is kind of like a space where people could really be free, I would think, at the time.
Tell the listeners, what time would that be?
Yeah, about? It was like the 60s. So it was around the Vietnam War. Uh-huh. You know, it was around that time where he just, you know, didn't really want to be in the States. And we had some family that lived in Europe. So he, you know, it was a win-win for him. So that's why he went to Europe to really get a grasp on just kind of being free, I would think, you know. And then moving here from Jamaica was not an easy transition, you know, like being an immigrant and being black is a lot different than being a black American. So he had a little tension there too, which I think that was, you know, all of those things just kind of
Jamaica wasn't cool.
And it ended up
cool
just, you know, he had to go. He felt like he had to leave.
You said he came in the amnesty program?
Well, yeah, my grandparents were part of the amnesty program, so they lived here for about 7 years and then brought over the rest of the family once that time was up. So it was like the late 50s, early 60s.
And how did the amnesty program work, from what you know?
Well, you get sponsored by a family here, so they worked. My grandmother was a maid, and my grandfather was a butler for a Jewish family in the South Suburbs. And so they were there just working for them for, you know, that amount of time. But my grandfather also spent a lot of time learning other trades. So he learned how to become a plumber. So he was a plumber that he basically taught himself and built his own house in the South Suburbs.
So your father, he starts making pictures. I like to always say make pictures, not take pictures. Another photographer told me that once.
Right.
You make pictures, you don't take them.
Yeah.
It's like painting with light.
Yeah, right.
That's like, I consider it painting with light.
Yeah. So he starts making pictures of, and I went to the show last 2 months, 6 weeks ago. So Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin. Mm-hmm. So tell what happened there.
So
was that, did he do that in Europe? Is that where he first met them?
Yes. So he was he was like a staff photographer for newspapers. So he got a press pass and he was able to get into shows. So he, you know, being who he was, he just walked up on stages and started taking pictures.
You can't do that anymore.
No.
Yeah.
No. You can't do that. So. Yeah. He was at a Jimi Hendrix concert. He took some pictures of that. And there was some Diana Ross of the Supremes and Aretha Franklin. And there's some other rock and roll musicians. I can't remember at the top of my head. But there's a good, with all the musician series, there's a good 3,000 or 4,000 images in that.
Three or 4,000 images.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to get to that in a minute, but this is, brings Keith into the story. So how did you two meet, and tell us what we saw at the exhibit, and maybe you got some other shows coming up you want to plug. But so, Keith, how did you meet the family?
Actually, I met Vanessa through a friend, and she had looked at, like, I this collection is, like, incredible. Like I said, first of all, I'm honored to even touch these images, and that's the whole purpose and the point of my work is that I can paint, so I can paint images and I can render them and make them look like they just look, but a rendering of his work is just only my work, and then it doesn't show Mr. Crichton's, like, his gift. So what I've been learning to do is, like, people don't already know how to paint, so I don't have to paint them. I accent them or embellish them.
Yeah, tell us step by step what you do. Maybe take an example of, like, what did I saw? I saw Hendrix, right? You did Hendrix.
Oh, yeah.
So let's use Jimi Hendrix. He has the image of Hendrix. Then how do you enhance it without going overboard? You
exactly.
Know?
Yeah. What I do is, like, you can't even hardly tell, but in some parts of the face, I actually bring out parts that you don't see in his photographs. Parts that, like, if you looked at his photograph at a glance, you would look over it. I look for things in his photograph that you would miss.
Now, how long did that take you, accident? Though?
It took me...
It took him like 2 months.
It took months.
Like, he had those images for 2 months, and I was like, okay, what are you going to do? Are you going to do stuff with them?
Yeah, did you supervise?
No. I just kind of, I trusted Keith. I knew that, just with the type of,
And there were a lot of other artists in Chicago, artists in the work. There's hundreds of artists in Chicago that would love to touch these photos, to actually be working with Vanessa with this project. And she has the opportunity to work with anybody, and her family, like, this work is incredible. He's got some, these photos are one of a kind of rare things. And what I wanted to do was show his work and then just accent them. So what I did was the first layers, I do them in like 20 or 30 layers, and I do these real subtle layers. Like, I accent the highlights in the face or things like that. And as I get out into further layers, then that's when I go crazy. And then I color and I paint all over it. But you can't, I don't want you to notice where I paint. Like, I want you to look at it and not even notice that I painted it. Only just see it, like, and then I put real jewels and embellishment. Like, I did Thelonious Monk and Jimi Hendrix. I put, like, the Jimi Hendrix, like, I got real guitar strings in it.
Yeah, right.
Like, that's a one, and I wanted to accent the, in that photo, the thing about that photo that people don't realize is what she told me is that that's the only photograph of him with his favorite white guitar.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's no pictures of Jimi Hendrix. One of his guitars. I don't remember.
With that one guitar, there's no published photos of him, of that guitar.
Yeah. Wow.
And this guy got these photos, right? So I put real guitar strings in the painting. And, like, he's bending the riff. I got where his finger's pushing it. He's bending the riff. And I got real guitar. And then I layer all those, like, metal, jewelry, paint, all of that in layers and crunch it.
It's fantastic. You know, I'd heard about it through my neighbor over there in Ukrainian Village. And yeah. Martha. Yeah. And but then when I went to the show, it's just, where can people see this? You got any shows coming up? Is there a website people can look at?
Yeah, so you could go to CreighneyPhoto.com. That's my dad's website. But we're putting together a crowdfunding campaign, and that will be coming up soon in the next week or so. And that would be, you could look for that on Facebook under Reawakening Vision, which is the name of the show that
we're gonna Reawakening
do.
Vision.
So we're looking at really looking at doing something possibly at the Cultural Center in the next couple years or so. We really want to work on this body of work first. And then, you know, Keith is also, he has these huge canvases, so he's going to do whatever he does with those canvases using my dad's photography and also mine.
Again.
And mine too, because I'm a photographer
like I said,
myself.
It's an honor.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I worked with her and her dad. Like, the one thing I noticed is, like, what we did was, like, when I started working with her dad's work, I realized she's a photographer, too, and she's kind of just like her dad in the way that they shoot light.
What do you mean? Talk about that.
I swear to God, like, I think kids inherit stuff genetically that they don't even know, like that you won't even realize.
Well, how did he use light?
Like, he paints with light. There's a lot of contrast.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of contrast. But he also done, like, really incredible things. Like, this guy did slide film on the fly in the 70s. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. Like, there's over 300,000 images in his collection.
And so, slide film, you know. And one of the things I'm doing, I also do have a show. I actually do have a show of some of, like, the whole full body, like, not the full body of work, because, like you said, so many of them, but the Zobe Art Center.
Oh, okay.
Next Friday.
And where's that at? And we got to take a break. Where's that at?
35th, I think. The Zobe Art Center, 35th and...
Spell it and people can look it up.
Z-H-O-U.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a break and we're going to be back and talk about this remarkable photography on WGN. It's in the photograph. Excellent audible there, Dan Long. That's very, very good. Okay, we're here with artists Vanessa Stokes and Keith Brownlee, and we're talking about the work of Vanessa's father, Dorrell Creighton. Now, he passed in 2011.
Yes.
January 30th, 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So how prepared were you? I mean, did you know where the archives were? Mm-hmm. Did he walk you through stuff? You know, in other words, how hands-on were you? Where to go with the next step?
So we've been working, my sister and I had been looking through his images for a while. And so we had it categorized and we knew where some things were, but not so much. So over some time, after he passed away, I thought it was a great way to, like, reconnect, kind of go through just, you know, the bereavement process. Mm-hmm. I thought it would be a really great way to kind of reconnect with my dad and kind of look through his things. And I just found just so many just really interesting things. It got me, like, really wanting to do more with it. So I wrote a grant and got some money from DK's to do a show. We had a show at the Silver Room in 2014. And then I got another grant from DK's the following year to do some of my own kind of professional development. So I went to the Art Institute and took just a graphic design course and a digital photography class, and really kind of started falling in love with photography.
Wow, what a great transition!
Yeah,
for you. You know, so that's what I was going to ask is, was there two things? Was there a two-part question? Was there an image that you found that you never knew about, maybe the more important question is, what did you learn about your father that maybe you didn't know before in going through this?
I found some pictures of Miles Davis.
Did you really?
That I thought were really neat. They're a little damaged, but you know, you could still fix them.
Do you know where they were made?
Taken here in Chicago, probably at the Plug Nickel, I'm thinking.
Yeah, he did a lot of stuff on Lake Street, man.
Did he really?
Yeah, the Plug Nickel.
Remember those Dizzy Gillespie pieces?
Yeah, but those were taken at the Plug Nickel, which was a jazz club.
Yeah.
And so...
sitting in the corner with like just
yeah, they're really
his horn.
Yeah, there's
know,
some
like,
really
oh,
neat,
ooh,
jazz
beautiful stuff. Dizzy Gillespie.
The access. I mean, we talked about it earlier, but the accessibility he had.
Yeah,
it'll never happen again.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he got really close. I mean, really close to people, really intimate.
Not
and that's
just
what I
stars,
noticed.
But just people on the street.
Oh yeah, let's talk about that. But in the time we have left,
not just stars. He like some of his just regular images of street people. He was able to just. He got naked pictures of Twiggy somewhere. Like, I mean, he could just make people just...
Did he really? Is there naked pictures
of
Twiggy?
No. There are pictures of Twiggy, but she's fully clothed.
She's fully clothed.
Yeah, she's clothed. There's a lot of really neat images in the collection. Like, all different types of things. Like, my dad was... The one thing that I've learned about his art was that he was able to put himself in that image. And that's what really, once I really started to look at, because my dad was always happy. He was always happy. He was always full of life. And that kind of transcended into those images. So a lot of the street images, he was like, you know, he was smiling and everybody smiled back, you know.
Was he a music fan? I mean, he hung on the clubs and stuff, but did you know if he had a record a big record collection?
Well, he just went with one of his friends, I think, like Chester Sherd, who was also a photographer, and he took a lot of pictures. He worked for like a lot of different publications in Milwaukee and here in Chicago. So he and my dad would go out and shoot and do all different types of things. So I think that's how he got into the jazz photography here in Chicago.
This is I like to think I know a little bit about some of the stuff. I've been around town for a while, but this is a great unknown. To me, it's an unknown story.
Yeah, it's very unknown.
Am I right or not?
No, you're totally right.
Well, I mean, people are going to know about him, and they're going to know how he touched. He was.
That's why I wanted to do something with him, and especially with Keith. And I think that, you know, by combining these two artists, and they're, you know, just prolific. I mean, because Keith is an amazing artist.
Yeah.
Not only does he paint, but he's a fabricator and he's a designer. And, you know, like he could make anything from metal or wood or anything.
The stuff I saw
amazing.
Was just beautiful.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
so that's why we decided to come together and do something.
All right, well, this is great. So is there a website people can look at?
You can look at Creightney. photo.com. That's CREIGHTNEY photo.com. And then Keith's website is Kaya, KAYAART.com. That's his. And then on Facebook, you can look at Keith Brownlee. He has a Facebook page. I do too, Vanessa Stokes. But the Reawakening Vision is the collaboration. So there's a Facebook page for that.
And we have all the artists that we're going to include later too. We got some surprise artists that we might include in
our collaboration. Okay. Yeah,
Vanessa's going to be involved, like also.
Yeah,
too.
I'm going to put some
I've worked on her pieces too as well with her dance, and I've been trying to blend in them.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. We'll have to keep people abreast of how things are going and how things are evolving. You'll have to come back.
Yes, we will. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Dave.
Thanks. Say hi to Martha for me.
We'll
be back after David Jennings the News on WGN.
Well, I got a weeping willow tree in my backyard. It's while I hang all of my troubles on. Whenever times get hard, you'll hear me singing a song, a morning, night, and noon. And if I sing an old blues song, it's 'cause I like the tune. I'll leave the crying to the rain.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN. That's a little bit of Melinda Mullins doing Leave the Crying to Rain, father's song, Johnny Mullins. Melinda, are you there from Springfield, Missouri?
Good evening, Dave. I am here in Springfield, Missouri, where it's much hotter than it is in Chicago. I just heard your weather forecast.
Yeah, lots of rain.
And we're in the 90s right now.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Good evening.
Hi. And also on the phone is Michael McCall, museum editor at the Country Music Hall of Fame. Are you there, Michael?
I am, Dave.
How you doing?
Glad to be here, man. I'm doing great.
So we've
glad
got
to be here. Glad to be able to talk about this topic.
So, yeah.
So, and honored to be here with Melinda, whose father I have great admiration for. So, hi, Melinda.
Thank you. Good to meet you on the phone. Hello.
Yes, exactly.
So first of all, let's talk a little about Springfield, Missouri. We're going to do a thing next weekend. We're finally going to show this documentary we've been working on for about 5 years about Springfield. It's titled Center of Nowhere, The Spirit and Sounds of Springfield, Missouri. So, Michael and Melinda, both tell us about why Springfield is important and why it's been neglected.
Who wants to go first?
Go ahead, Melinda, and I'll follow up. So you go ahead.
Well, I speaking from my point of view, I'm not going to talk about the neglected part. I'm going to talk about how amazing Springfield is because I have the background with the music of my father and the era that he moved to Springfield from Berry County, which is, just a couple hours away from Springfield. But he moved up here because he was a songwriter, and Springfield was just a buzz with the Ozark Jubilee. So this was, he met Porter Wagoner like in 1954, which is when Porter recorded my dad's song, Company's Coming. And that was the genesis of the Ozarks Jubilee. And there were so many people coming into this city because it was music, and it was entertainment. And it was so energetic. You could probably feel it from hundreds and hundreds of miles away. And after the Jubilee left, there were people that went ahead and went down to Nashville or went to different places to do their careers. But a lot of people thought, the Ozarks is a beautiful place. We've got lakes, we've got rivers, we've got our music. So many, many people stayed here, and it's just continued to be a really amazing place to play music, to hear music. In fact, just about half an hour ago, I was looking at Facebook on this Springfield, what's going on? And this weekend, there are over 39 different events just on this one page.
Right.
And I'm in the middle of three gigs myself doing my daddy's music. It's a good place to be.
The thing that drove us to do the documentary was, and we get this from so many people that are in the documentary, Robbie Folks, who I know you saw today, Michael, and Roscoe, Eric Amble, and we saw it on all my trips to there, it's a hard place to get to. You really do have to make an effort to get to, and one thing we try to bring out is how that, there's a real purity in the art and in the music there. And sense of place and location is really important thing. This is just not a music documentary. We're trying to talk about all the little characteristics that influence the art in Springfield, whether it be Route 66, whether it be religion, whether it be the lakes and hills that we're talking about, or the cashew chicken. Can you talk about, Michael, can you talk about how important sense of place is in music and regional music? That's my argument, is I think this is the most neglected of all the mid-range cities in the United States. I think the one that people don't know much about.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two levels of that. There's always, so much great American music has come out of hills and mountains, and people are sort of removed a bit from, connecting to other regions. Whether you're talking about bluegrass music, and you go through America, and a lot of places that are a little bit isolated have always created a sort of a style of music and have a vibe or a feel or a style of their own. And Springfield had that. And then I think, the next part of it was that, KWTO and the Ozark Jubilee were just so well run and became a draw. So everybody who was making music in the area or any place nearby wanted to come there and play because it was one of the great barn dances of the 50s in the same way that the National Barn Dance was in Chicago or the Grand Ole Opry and Nashville, back in the 50s, there were a lot of these live radio stations and weekends. But made, you know, the Jubilee sort of take a step above was when they got a TV contract, mm-hmm. and it was 1955, and country music was struggling. You know, rock and roll had hit, and all of a sudden, country is a little less popular. And having a network TV show every week was so important to country music. You know, I mean, and every big star in country music came there. Patsy Cline, Eddie Arnold, you know, it created stars like Brenda Lee and Porter Wagner and Wanda Jackson. Johnny Cash had one of his first shows there. I think Carl Perkins was first on TV ever there. Barbara Mandrell was first on TV in 1960 on the 5-Star Jubilee. It just became such an important place for exposing country music to the nation, you know, and it was a very popular show. And Red Foley, who was a, you know, a country star, but also in a way a pop star, you know, was the host for several years, and they had this incredible band, and it was a very entertaining show, and it really helped country music sort of survive during a time when it was having some trouble.
When I did that series for the magazine for the Country Music Hall of Fame years ago, in the early 2000s, Wayne Carson, and I want to introduce him here in a minute, but he told me Springfield is nearly the dead center of the United States. It's the wheel, and the spokes go out from there. I mean, it's just,
that, right.
I mean, you know, we talk about it. Route 66 was born in Springfield and stuff. Tell us, both of you, who Wayne Carson was. Because what I'm trying to do there is take it from the Ozark Jubilee to Wayne Carson, you know, writes the letter, gets the publishing money, and all these studios, like, you know, the Lou and some of the guys, some of the Daredevils.
And the Daredevils.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah.
Right. So tell us about Wayne Carson.
I'll go first on this one then. So, you know, Wayne, you know, his parents were on the Jubilee, Shorty and Sue, and Shorty Thompson was a, you know, member of the Tall Timbers band. He had his own, you know, solo career, and he had a duo with his wife. They moved there from Colorado to be in Springfield because it was such a good radio station and good radio show. And he, you know, grew up around music, started writing songs. His very, you know, very first song, he was encouraged by Cy Simon, who ran the Jubilee, and he couldn't get, he'd written a lot of songs. They were trying to get them to somebody. Nobody would pay attention. And all of a sudden, Chet Atkins heard one song that, somebody like me, that Eddie Arnold called Wayne and said, you know, I like it, but needs one more verse. And Wayne said, oh, here it is. And he wrote it right in his head. On the phone, talking to Chet, and it was a number one country. It was a number one country song in 1966, and then the next year he had a number one rock song with the letter.
Yeah,
you know, so and that was sort of Wayne Carson's thing. Is he had cuts by Ike and Tina Turner, and he had cuts, you know, by all kinds of country stars. You know, so
he wrote all those great Gary Stewart hits.
Oh, the Gary man, yeah. You know, Drinking Thing, and you know. So he took that money and reinvested in Springfield. He opened a studio there, and that you know became sort of the next step for Springfield. You know, past the TV show, is they needed in a recording center. You know, needed something that records were made, and I think Lou Whitney, you know, who you mentioned earlier, had his first job there and learned. You know, how to record songs there and then work in a studio. And it just was, there's steps that go on. And that was such an important step.
It sure was.
In Springfield's evolution.
You know, I mean, we say this a lot on this show. A place isn't a place until it's remembered. And, you know, a story is not a story until it's told. Michael, can you tell people what's going to be happening next weekend with the Springfield stuff? And especially stuff people can look at and watch that can't get to Nashville.
Right. Right. Yeah, we have... you know, you can go to countrymusichalloffame.org and watch these things. But we built this whole weekend around Springfield because, you know, using your documentary as sort of springboard for it, because it gave us a chance to talk about that. And any chance we have to talk about the important history of country music in Springfield was something we, you know, that we know is so important to everything that came afterwards. So we're having... your film premiere, which is really the centerpiece of everything, is it'll be the first time that Center of Nowhere has been shown to the public. But we're also having a program on the day before, so Sunday the 20th is the film. On Saturday the 19th, we're having a program and some panel discussion that will include, you know, rare videos, a lot of rare audio. We have some demos by Wayne Carson that nobody's ever heard. You know, that's never been released on a record. We'll have, you know, a lot of rare photos, Scott Simon, who's Cy Simon's son, and a big music executive in Nashville. He's Tim McGraw's manager, and it once ran Sony Records and signed the Dixie Chicks and has a great history in Nashville. He'll be on the panel. Robbie Foulkes is coming from Chicago to be a part of it. Eric Ambel, who you mentioned earlier, who is a member of the Del Lords and Roscoe's Gang and Joan Jett and the Blackhearts and all these great bands. He's coming down because he loved coming to Springfield to make records.
Yeah.
Vance Powell, who came out of Springfield, is going to be on the record or on the panel. So we have this, we just want to celebrate the idea of what Springfield is, you know, from the beginning all the way through to now.
Okay.
And that will be on, that will be broadcast. It'll be streamed live, but you can also come on the website anytime afterwards, and we'll keep it online, and it'll be there for, you know, as long as we have a website.
Okay, we got to take a break, and then we want to come back and talk about Melinda and Loretta Lynn and some of the other things coming up at the museum. So don't all go right. away on Nocturnal Journal.
Meet me at the airport and kiss me as I fly away. We could spend a week or maybe just a couple days. I can't figure out how to live two places at once. I'm just trying to go outside and have a little fun. Creeps they have eyes watching all the time, but they don't mind when I'm with you.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. That's our house band, the Dumpster Babies from Chicago. Thank you for doing a little country backroads thing there. Thanks, Graham. Are you guys still there?
Still here.
I'm okay. Here.
All right. So talk about the connection, Melinda, with your dad and Loretta Lynn.
Oh, that's a good story. Well, after Dad got his foot in the door with Porter Wagner Recording Company's coming in 1954, in 1962, this sweet little gal named Loretta Lynn had just signed to Decca Records. And Teddy and Doyle Wilburn, who my dad knew, he ended up knowing a bunch of people because of the Ozark Jubilee and also through Cy Simon, because Cy and he, through Earl Barton Music, they had a connection. He was the publisher. And so Teddy and Doyle gave Dad Dad's song called Success Has Made a Failure of Our Home to Loretta. And that was one of her first top 10 hits. And she said, "Hey, Johnny, I really like this song. Will you write me another one?" And my daddy said, "Well, yes, Loretta, I will." So sitting on the corner of State and Fort Street in Springfield, Missouri, he wrote a song for her. She's got blue eyes, and she's from Kentucky. So he wrote this song called Blue Kentucky Girl. And, you know, it's interesting because Michael was talking about Wayne Carson, and, like, Dad and Wayne took two different paths. Wayne was so incredibly into the industry and recording and the business side of everything. And my dad was an elementary school janitor.
Right.
He just didn't want to get into... He loved writing songs. He was such a people watcher.
Okay.
And so he got a...
We're gonna have to break here for the news. But before, Michael, tell us about the Loretta Lynn exhibit before we have to run.
Yeah, and it's called Blue Kentucky Girl, yeah. And that's what an important song that was
I'm
to her.
I'm so excited.
And I have to say, you know, Success was her first top 10 song, and Blue Kentucky Girl was about her fifth. And at that point, she was not writing her own songs. And I think she studied Johnny Mullen's songs and some of the stuff that she was recording that was successful for her. And part of why she became such a great songwriter herself was that she studied guys like Johnny Mullins, you know, and it really was so important to her. You know?
Okay. Wow. We could go on and on, but I've been doing that for 5 years. So, this thing's about over. We could have done about a 4-hour documentary, but maybe, you know, we'll do a director's cut. Anyway, thank you guys. We're going to also do a screening in Springfield at the end of June, right? All right, Melinda? So we'll see you then.
What day is that?
I think it's June 29th. I didn't bring those notes in, but I know we'll all be in Nashville next weekend. So thank you so much. Thanks.
Well,
go ahead.
I have a great time, and I wanted to tell you I've got a little campfire going here in my backyard tonight. So Michael, come on up, and Dave, come on down, and we'll chat some more.
Okay. Right. Thanks, Michael.
That'd be great. Yeah.
Thanks, Michael. And we'll see
you, Dave.
See you soon. Okay. Thank you. And we'll be back
next week. Yeah.
Okay. We'll be back with more after David Jennings in the news on WGN.
Have you got a story to tell? Got a story for me? Something that I've never heard. Something that will stay with me. 'Cause I've heard it all.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN. That's Anna Soltis. Thank you. You've been on the show before in a group setting, right?
Yep, with Amy and Vivian Garcia.
Yeah, so thank you. Thank you for coming in again.
Thanks for having me back. It's always lovely.
Tell us about that song.
It's one of my newer songs. Thank you. And I wanted to bring it to you because, well, you've had a lot of really great things happening with your book and travel and stories, and it's what you do. You tell stories. And I feel like as artists, all of us here, tell stories, and so, you know.
Wow, that's very nice. That's very nice. Well, thank you. Thank you. That's the best thing that's happened to me in a couple weeks. Right? Okay. Does that song have a title?
Stories.
Stories.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know.
All right. So you've got you're on the show because you've got a record release party. This is your first record.
It's my first record, debut album.
And it's going to be May 18th at Martyrs.
Correct.
And tell us a little about the record, and I want to go backwards into your journey to this record.
Yeah. Thanks. I'm really excited about this record. It's a 9 song compilation of work that started about 7-8 years ago, and some of the songs are newer. But it took a really long time to get to this point, and it's the first piece of anything that I have to share with anybody physically, and it is the most cathartic feeling I've ever had in my life. And I've been playing music for a long time now, and I've been on other people's records, but guess what? I've got my own. So May 18th is going to be exciting. Amy Soraya is playing that night with The Outcome. They're having a reunion for the show. And then Ode, I don't know if you know about Ode, but they're an amazing, ridiculous band, and I did a little bit of vocals on their album as well.
You guys know Ode?
I haven't heard of the band.
Oh, God. Come May 18th, you will be blown away. And it's 3 bands, you know, no opening, like, acoustic act. 3 full badass bands.
For our studio band here and for the listeners, tell us about your journey. I mean, I want to touch on public art since we talked about photography and stuff in the first segment, but Poland to France to Chicago. You said one thing once that art was the only language that you had.
Yeah.
So tell me where you were born and tell me what brought you to Chicago.
So I was born in Poland in Kraków, and I moved with my mom to Paris. My uncle was an artist and moved around, and then when I was 12, I moved to Chicago. So when I was 12, I moved to Chicago. I had no language. I didn't speak English when I moved here, and
you
it was very not a word. I mean, maybe hello. But me and my friends used to pretend like we spoke English in the playgrounds of Paris. You know, it was cute. Whatever. But when I moved here, it was during a time when, like, what are those? What's that boy band called? Like, not NSYNC, but the first band came out.
Graham, you know that.
Whatever.
I think my sister was into that. The New Kids on the Block.
New Kids on the Block. Thank you, Graham.
So
that's why you're here.
So I come.
Now you can leave. No, I'm kidding.
So I come to this country after having lived in Paris, where I listened to like Serge Gainsbourg and like Vanessa Paradis.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Right,
and that to me felt very adult. And then I like went to school and like all these kids were wearing like New Kids on the Block t-shirts. No offense, y'all, but it just really didn't rub me the right way. And I spoke no English, so I couldn't even talk about it. But it was very isolating. And I would go home, and I would listen to 104.3. That was my jam, you know. Dick Biondi would take me through the rest of my evening, you know. And I didn't understand what they
we
were
love
singing
Dick
about.
Here. Yeah,
I mean, he's the best,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
His voice will...
He's older than me.
Yeah. And he... So that, you know, American music then became this thing in my mind. And I didn't understand... But I would just... I didn't understand the lyrics or anything like that. But that the history of American music, which is something that you are so... you know, adamant and share so beautifully, was something that became important. I never realized I was going to play music. I always thought I was going to be a fine artist, but that's where the music is rooted from. That's where this album is rooted from, is that sentiment and those ideals.
What a sense of discovery, and maybe for you guys too. I mean, when you find new things, I think you and I talked once years ago about Karen Dalton. Just what's it like when stuff like that, the process of discovery, and how do you harness that and make it your own?
Yeah, well, I wrote a song for Karen Dalton the album called Lone Blues. It's what do you say about it? You know, it's like it just changes. It changes who you are, and then you can't ignore it, right? Something happens, and you're like, now what? And then you just take those steps to kind of fulfill your, you know, limitless ambition.
We should say again who Karen Dalton. I mean, she had a very minimalist style, kind of under the radar.
During Bob Dylan days in New York, she was discovered. I forget the dude's name, but he was a producer in New York, and he wrote a bunch of songs for her. And she had this super soulful, very strong voice. And if you would have heard her voice, you would have never paired it with a tiny little Irish girl, you know, with missing teeth, like ever. And she unfortunately had a very short life, and the story is kind of tragic. And she ended up, you know, dying in New York, super young, and never really made it. I mean, during that time with Joni Mitchell and all them, so there was a lot of competition for the cool female singer. But she her voice and her albums are unbelievable.
We got to take a break, and we're going to come back with more on WGN's Nocturnal Journal.
It's felt like it's all been over before. It's felt like it's all come crashing down. I can't look anymore. Just when you think it's over, the world will crush you down. A little more. Open light, oh, open light. Can you let me lay here just one more night? Open light, oh, open. Stay here tonight. It's all worth it. They all love to say. Nothing comes that easy, but it's all meant to help you on your way. Lessons seeping in your pores. It's all working to build a waterfall of hope that you've been longing for. Open light, oh, open light. Can you let me lay all night? Open light, oh, open light. Can you let me lay here just one more night? Open light.
Anna Soltis on WGN's Nocturnal Journal, May 18th at Martyrs on the north side of Chicago. That's from the new record?
It's not. It's a new song.
Okay. Tell me about that song. I was looking for a title.
Yeah. It's called Open Light. You know, this record took so long to put out that it's interesting. I think a lot of people talk about this when they put out a record. It's like they've sang the song so many times that it's exciting to kind of get past it. The release of this record is very exciting because the songs on there I do love a lot. I've been playing them a very long time, and it's nice to be able to share them with people. And at the same time, I'm ready to start playing new songs too. Personally, yeah.
You've been. I mean, do you want to talk about? You said it was a it was a good process for you. I mean, you've been through a lot. You had talk about what you mean by that. I know you had a kid, right?
I had
tomorrow's
a child.
Mother's Day, right?
Tomorrow, yeah. I'm a mom.
Yeah,
I have. So this is, you know, this album is my first baby, but I had it after my second baby. You know how that is. So this record took a really long time. I was signed with a label. The record got shelved. There was a lot of stuff that happened, and it's, you know, 7-8 years later, and it's, you know, I think I felt jailed. I felt mentally crippled for a really long time, and to be honest, it almost, you know, I didn't know I would ever release this record. So the fact that it's happening on May 18th is this new life for me. Giving birth was the first, I think, personal reawakening that maybe there's more to life than just disappointments.
Right.
But anyways, yeah. And there, you know, a lot of people came together to make this happen. I mean, from lawyers, my dear friend Michael Komisar, my dear friend Jamie Habercon, who actually helped me buy my name back, if you will.
Yeah.
I mean, the story happens over and over. Lots of artists, lots of musicians have issues and have these kinds of situations, and so it's not special.
What's it like, Graham, and you guys to just stick with it like that, and you know, 7 years she was talking about it, to stick with the project and then see it through?
I mean, it's really tough to just kind of keep, you know, plowing through, especially trying to put stuff out, like, because we generally do stuff on our own, essentially. We've had some label support in the past, but really it's up to, as far as paying for recording and, you know, getting it out there, that's been on us. So I was actually going to ask you, like, is this new recording, like, totally solo? Are you doing it independently by yourself? Or
I am, yeah. Yeah. I very reluctantly sign anything these days.
You will have a band at Martyrs,
oh,
right?
Yes.
Tell us about the band.
My band, yeah. Man. And these guys have stuck with me from the beginning. So I've got the amazing Larry Beers on drums, who, you know, plays with the best of the best in Chicago. Mr. John Piricello on guitar, who also does some pedal steel and mandolin on the record, who is just a badass. He owns Lakeland Bass and Hanson Guitars. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Lakeland
guy over here. Yeah, so he's incredible. And then Mr. Dave Smith on bass, who's a Mooka guy and does a lot of cool stuff. So, and then we're missing Greg Hurt, who was part of the band, but he moved to L.A. Yeah.
Okay, give us the website and how people can get. When does it actually come out?
So the record comes out on that day.
Okay.
I do have it physically in my hand already, but, you know, might as well just hold off one more week since I've waited 7 years. Yeah. So May 18th at Martyrs. The website is annasoltismusic.com. There's my contact information on there. Check it out. There's going to be links to the actual music. It'll be on all the, you know, social platforms. La di da di da di da.
Well, thanks for coming in.
Oh my God, thanks for having
so
me.
Sweet.
Dave. Thank
that
you.
Was really, really, really
on Mike. Happy Mother's Day, by the way. That was amazing.
Yeah.
Glad to be here for
you. You really lit up the room tonight.
Thank you. And you know what? The last time I was here, Dave, I just want to say that I was 4 months pregnant. So it's really funny to be here now the day before Mother's Day, releasing this record.
Thank you very much. We're going to be back with the Dumpster Babies. Oh, no pun.
Let's just go ahead and segue into that.
Yeah, and we're back for David.
Lower the IQ in the room a little bit.
On WGN.
Too far from your eye. Oh, 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 oh.
Go the Dumpster Babies on Nocturnal Journal on WGN. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Graham, tell us who the band is and what you got here.
So we got Mr. John Gorman on the bass guitar and vocals, Tom Pushouts on guitar and vocals, and his brother Paul Pushouts right now on percussion and backup
tambourine
vocals.
Man.
Tambourine
and,
man.
Just right and now. Graham Good. Graham Guitar, I guess. Graham is his name.
And what was that song?
That song's called Single Tear.
And what's the history of that song?
We wrote it.
that's
four months ago.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of similar thing where we've been playing a lot of the old stuff since Graham started the band, and now that he's been in the fold about a year or so now.
Yeah, I guess I've been playing with you guys for a little over a year
yeah,
now.
Yeah, so now we're really writing, trying out some new stuff, so...
And how this band get together? I guess Graham, how'd you find them?
Well, John and I've been playing in bands since I moved to Chicago. I mean, I started at a bar called Small Bar on Division Street back in the day, and he kind of worked.
Were you
nearby.
Playing there?
I just
or working, bar, working,
yeah,
working
there. Yeah,
yeah.
He'd play if you gave him a big enough tip.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but I met John and a bunch of other people, and they just kind of drafted me into all their bands, and here it is, 12 years later, we're still playing together.
Yeah, and you came from Chattanooga?
Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Yeah. And why did you come to Chicago?
A really good friend of mine who sang in a band and played drums, he moved up here, and I came to visit him and just kind of fell in love with it. Wanted to come up here and do something different.
Okay, and how long ago was that?
12 years almost, yeah, November 3rd, 2006.
And Anna, when did you start, like, on the scene? Was it?
Oh, yeah, I mean, like, 7-8 years ago.
So where I'm going with all that is how's the scene evolved? 12 years, 7 years, you know. What's changed for the better, what's changed for the worse?
I feel it's a little different. I mean, definitely with, like, the way the digital, you know, everything's digital now, it's a... You know, you don't just go out and, you know, cover everything with flyers and hope someone shows up. You definitely can kind of blast what you think is your target audience might be. But
yeah, there's a lot of smaller labels and DIY stuff where, just like not necessarily like a bigger record company. It's just like...
Yeah, I feel with that, with like
someone's little project.
Well, stuff like Bandcamp, it makes it a lot easier for bands to get their music out there, maybe get a little money back, and they'll try to put out like a vinyl record or, you know, be able to put themselves out that way instead of having to go through a label and hope that they'll pay for like the huge chunk of like getting a record out. So,
How do you describe your sound? I heard a little surf there, but in the first set I asked you to do a little country thing, so thank you for that.
Well, if you're going to have Graham Corder in your band, you're going to have a little surf in your band. That's a... comes with the territory. Graham is the greatest guitarist I've ever had the pleasure of playing with in my entire life. He's trying to be humble, but I'm gonna have to grab the mic here. And this dude is amazing. Since the first time I heard this guy play guitar, at my wedding, as a matter of fact, 10 years ago in 3 days.
Oh wow!
This guy was playing on the beach, North Carolina, for my wedding. But yeah, our sound, I don't know.
Yeah, it's always...
it's evolved, yeah. I guess. We started as
our name's Dumpster Babies.
We started as a
punk garage band.
It started out as a knucklehead punk band.
Yeah.
And,
I think some of us got better so we could play different stuff now. Instead of like 2-chord songs.
Right. So,
I don't know, you know, like you were saying before, you know, you get tired of playing the same old stuff over and over, and you're trying to push new stuff, and, you know, kind of just keep pushing and keep interested artistically, you know.
Yeah,
and,
but I guess, I mean, so what would you say, what do we sound like?
I think we're still kind of garagey.
Yeah, I'd say a little
yeah,
garagey.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I don't know, rock and roll. I say fun rock and roll that's catchy, right? Hopefully.
Poppier stuff to, like, a little bit more like hardcore punk, and then now it like turned into like Jesus and Mary Jane type of thing.
Yeah.
Country music, and
yeah. I guess I would tell it was like punk rock dudes that had children, and now it's a thoughtful dad punk. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
Dumpster daddies. That's what we're
Paul's kid's
for.
About to be in high school.
Yeah. Anna,
about
when
to
you
be in first grade.
Anna, when you form a band, I mean, how'd you get your group together?
It was all my drummer, Larry Beers. You know, I met him in a bar before I think I had 3 songs I'd written, and I met Larry and I fell in love with him. Not romantically, just as a person. And
what bar was that?
Oh God, I don't remember. Oh, okay. It was all that right. kind of night. But we kept in contact, and he just has such a strong. He's an epicenter of music, and so he really brought all these guys together.
That was one of the talking points that Graham and I came up with, was the role of the bar and restaurant industry in music, how it facilitates meeting like-minded individuals, uh-huh. and how that's changed. So, I mean, you guys, that's how I know you, Graham, from the Matchbox.
And, yeah, I feel yeah. it's a little different. Like, when I was coming up through high school, I remember, like, you know, getting my first bar job at 17 illegally and meeting a bunch of, like, other punk rock guys and, you know, starting bands, learning to play. And I moved up here, and, like, within 3 days of living here, I'd met 90% of my friends and bandmates for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And the bar industry, you know, for depending on how you look at it, for better or worse, it's now a lot of, like, I mean, a lot of us have degrees, or I don't, but some people do. Like, there's a lot more people coming out. But a lot of people coming out of college, like, they want to get in this industry, and they it's not as many actors and writers and musicians. It's a lot of people that are just dead set on becoming the best. And I think maybe a lot of, like, celebrity chef culture is kind of taking over the industry, or, you know.
Well, and I think even the vibe in the bars, you know, when I went to Columbia College, and I remember reading about artists, right, and how there was, like, groups of people where movements were happening, and they happened in these holes somewhere, right, in a hole somewhere, and that, it became my mission. I was like, I need to find mine, you know, and I did. The Underground Wonder Bar, the original on Walton Street, was my jam. I mean, all these musicians, all these people that were real and lived real lives and were happy and sad and whatever. And you know, you drank too much and then you grew.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, even back in the day, like way, way back in the day, like with the Earl of Old Town
I work in Old Town now.
So it's different now. Like, so many of the bars that are opening up, like, you're seeing a lot of the old watering holes close, and like these bright bars with a million TVs. Like, nothing says I want to start a band when you go into these like giant macro bars, you know, like it's not the same.
That's not where you're going to find your lonely introspective artist. Yeah.
All right, we got to take a break, and we'll try to get one more song in, you guys. Thanks for coming down. So don't go away.
Float, 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 float with you in the Dead Sea. You'll be in all my dreams that don't come true. You got suicide fever. Gonna go down deeper, spit on the Grim Reaper. You can't dive into a dream so shallow. You can't dive into a mind so narrow. Sit and think and figure it out from the inside. There's flowers in our minds that'll never bloom. You're at home all alone till you sink inside of your mattress with your dead man's glasses. You can see right past us. Ride with you into your shadows, 'cause the darkest steps are way too shallow. I can't ride with you into your shadows, 'cause the darkest steps are way too shallow.
Kickstart your heart, but I'm not like you're ready.
Excellent. The Dumpster Babies. Excellent. What was the... Well, tell us about that song.
That one's called Dead Sea, and I think I wrote it after seeing like some PBS show. I thought it was kind of a cool metaphor. I've never been there, but I think my parents just came back from there. They said there's a lot of sinkholes.
Inspiring.
Yeah.
Well, you guys are spot on. It's great. I think, you know, we got the camper van. We got you guys. We got Anna. We got Aubrey, Dan. We all just hit the road and go on a tour.
Let's roll.
I'm ready.
Dave, don't play with me.
It's like, so you're working on a record?
Yeah, we're trying to. We got a whole bunch of new songs that we're trying to kind of. We actually have them all together. We just got to find, agree on where we want to have them recorded at. So,
yeah, this will be our third record.
Third, your full third length. Record. Yeah. And how can people find the other two?
On Spotify, we got our first two records on there. Also, I believe Bandcamp.
If you want a physical copy, Tall Pat Records.
Okay. Or get a hold of us on
Dumpster
Facebook.
Tapes.
Or Dumpster Tapes put out the cassette tapes.
Do you all what are your other jobs and stuff? I know what you do, Graham. You're at the Matchbox.
I mean, John's over next door to Matchbox. He works there sometimes over at the Silver Palm.
Okay.
I work at like a art gallery oddity shop.
Oh, really?
If you need something weird,
is that the pleasure chest, is it?
No, it's like taxidermy.
Okay. Oh, really? Taxidermy?
It's called a Sideshow Gallery.
Oh, okay.
That's cool.
That's a great logo.
Yeah, Paul, he's probably embarrassed to say it, but he's a roller skating male stripper.
Yeah, and
I'll look him up at RolandPaul.com.
No. Also want to say hi to my daughter on that note. Hello, Guinevere.
Okay.
She just learned something.
Yeah, we're a lot of us are in the bars and restaurants, service industry, artists who are trying to make a dollar.
Yeah.
Before
still have
we
a little
make
time to do this.
What is it like, Anna, for going out and finding gigs and stuff? I mean, we've talked about that on the show before. I mean, someplace, I don't know, in L.A. about pay-to-play and stuff. I mean,
yeah.
How hard is it for all you guys to find work?
I'm not playing that much these days because, to get all of us and the band out, it just needs to be worth it, you know? So just right now it's just kind of picking picking the good stuff or trying to, but I don't know how you guys do it.
I think it just takes a little tenacity. You know, you just push it and get out there and find a friend who's got a show or know some people. They're throwing a party, and, you know, there's a ton of venues around town that'll let you play, and you know, as long as you're not expecting much, at least you can get out there and work on your stuff. And yeah, for us, I mean, we just kind of got to the point where, you know, people will ask us to play from time to time, and that's where we're at, you know. Yeah. So
it's been a little strange with a lot of places closing down too. Rest in peace, Quenchers.
Quenchers is going. Cal's, I mentioned earlier, that was a hub for me, you know.
Well, you always have Nocturnal Journal.
Yes.
And the street for a while. So thank you, Dumpster Babies, for coming down.
Thank you, Dave.
That was a really solid hour. Anna, that was great stuff.
Thank you so much.
And that's May 18th.
May 18th at Martyrs.
Okay. All right. Thank you all for listening. Thanks, Dan Long. Thanks, Aubrey Mumpower. We'll talk to you soon.